The carriage wheels made a soft sound on the gravel road as it rolled up to the great stone house. The house was called Thornwood Hall, and it sat on a hill above a small village in the county of Kent. Inside the carriage sat a young woman named Maren Ashby. She was 24 years old. She had not seen this part of England in 5 long years. She pressed her hand against the cold glass of the carriage window. Her breath made a small white circle on the pane. The smell of rain and wet earth came through the gap in the door. Somewhere in the distance, a crow called once and then again. Her fingers shook just a little. She made them stop. 5 years. The number sat in her chest like a stone she could not put down. The carriage stopped. A footman in dark green opened the door. Maren stepped down onto the gravel. Her shoes were plain and worn. Her dress was grey wool, well made but old. She had no jewels. She had no maid. She had only a small trunk and a heart that had taught itself not to hope. She had come to Thornwood Hall to work as a companion to an old woman named Lady Bramwell. The job had been arranged by a letter, written in a hand she did not know. The pay was fair. The room would be warm. That was all she needed. She did not know that Thornwood Hall belonged to the Duke of Marchcombe. She did not know that the Duke of Marchcombe was a man named Alistair Vance. She did not know that Alistair Vance had once, 5 years ago, danced with her for the length of one song in a small assembly room in the village of Pelham, and had been looking for her ever since. She did not know any of this. She walked up the stone steps with her head held low and her hands folded against her stomach. The wind pulled at her plain bonnet. The smell of wood smoke came from somewhere inside the house. A servant opened the great oak door. "Miss Ashby?" the servant asked. "Yes," she said. "Please come in. Lady Bramwell is expecting you." She stepped inside. The hall was tall and full of soft light. Candles burned in glass holders along the walls. A great staircase rose up into shadow. Somewhere far away, in another room, she could hear the small sound of a clock ticking. The air smelled of beeswax and old books, and something else, something faint and warm, like cedar. She did not look around her. She had learned not to look at fine things. Fine things were not for her, and to look too long was to want, and to want was the worst pain of all. The servant led her down a long hall. Her shoes made no sound on the deep red carpet. She passed paintings of men on horses, of women in white dresses, of dogs and hills and ships. She did not look at any of them. At the end of the hall was a door. The servant knocked once. "Come in," said a voice from inside. The door opened. Maren stepped through. The room was a drawing room, small and warm. A fire burned low in the grate. The smell of dried roses came from a bowl on a side table. By the window sat an old woman in a chair of green velvet. She had white hair pinned up in a soft knot. She wore black silk. Her hands were folded in her lap. Her eyes were sharp and kind at the same time. "Miss Ashby," the old woman said. "Come closer, child. Let me look at you." Maren came closer. She did not curtsy too low. She had no high station, but she had her own quiet pride. The old woman, who was Lady Bramwell, looked at her for a long moment. The fire made small popping sounds. Outside, a bird called from a tree. "You are tired," Lady Bramwell said at last. "Yes, my lady." "And hungry, I should think." "A little." "Sit down, child. We will have tea brought. We will not begin work today. Today you will rest, and tomorrow we will begin." Maren sat down on a low chair by the fire. She kept her back straight. She kept her hands folded. The warmth of the fire reached her face. She had not been truly warm in a long time. Lady Bramwell rang a small silver bell. A maid came in with a tray. There was tea in a blue pot. There was bread and butter and small slices of cold meat. There was a piece of seed cake on a white plate. Maren had not seen seed cake in 5 years. Her throat tightened. She made it untighten. "Eat, child," Lady Bramwell said. "You may speak between bites or not. I do not require talk." Maren ate slowly. The bread was fresh, and the butter was sweet. The tea was hot and strong. She felt the warmth go down into her stomach and spread out like a small sun. She did not know that 2 corridors away, in a study lined with dark wood, a tall man stood at a window and watched the rain begin to fall on the garden. He had heard the carriage arrive. He had heard the servant lead someone down the hall. He had not gone to look. He had told himself he must not look. Not yet. He had searched for her for 5 years. He had not stopped, not once. He had hired men. He had paid for letters. He had written down every detail he remembered from that one evening in Pelham. The color of her dress. The way she had laughed at his serious face. The way she had told him, in a small, calm voice, that she would not say her family name because it would be unkind to him later. He had let her go that night because he had been a younger man, and he had not yet known what mattered. He had spent 5 years learning. Now she was in his house. He had paid the agency. He had written the letter that had brought her here, in a hand she would not know. He had told his great-aunt, Lady Bramwell, only the truth that needed to be told, that this young woman was good and clever and in need of a kind place, and that he wished her hired. Lady Bramwell had asked no further questions. Lady Bramwell never did. He stood at the window. The rain made small silver lines on the glass. He pressed his palm flat against the cold pane. His breath came slow. He must not rush. He must not frighten her. He must let her settle. He must let her see the house first, and the kindness of his great aunt, and the warmth of the fires, and the quiet of the gardens. He must let her be safe for a while, before she knew anything at all. He turned from the window. He went back to his desk. He picked up his pen. He had work to do, and he would do it. That night, Maren slept in a small, clean room on the second floor. The bed had white sheets that smelled of lavender. The window looked out on a stone wall and a tree. She lay under the warm blanket and listened to the wind in the leaves. She thought she would not sleep. She slept. In the morning, the maid brought her hot water in a blue jug. There was bread and tea by the fire in Lady Bramwell's small sitting room. Lady Bramwell was already awake, reading a letter through a pair of small gold spectacles. "Good morning, child," she said. "You will read to me this morning. There is a book on the table, the one with the green cover." Maren picked up the book. It was a book of poetry. She opened it and began to read. Her voice was soft and steady. She had been told once, long ago, that she had a good reading voice. She did not remember who had told her that. She read until the morning sun moved across the carpet. Lady Bramwell closed her eyes. She did not sleep. She listened. "You read well," she said when Maren paused. "You have been taught." "My mother taught me," Maren said, "before she died." "And your father?" "He died also, 2 years after." "You have no family?" "None close, my lady." Lady Bramwell nodded slowly. She did not press. She turned the talk to the weather and the garden and the small dog that had once lived in this house and had been a great trouble to everyone. Maren found, after a time, that she was smiling. She had not smiled in many days. This was how the first week passed. Maren read in the mornings. She walked with Lady Bramwell in the garden in the afternoons, when the weather was fair. She wrote letters that Lady Bramwell told her to write. She did small tasks of mending. She ate 3 meals a day. She slept under lavender sheets. She did not see the Duke. She knew there was a Duke. The servants spoke of him with quiet respect. She heard a footstep sometimes in a far hall. She saw, once, a tall figure pass at the end of a corridor, and she stepped back into a doorway without thinking. She did not want to be in anyone's way. She did not know, of course, that the tall figure had paused at the end of the corridor, that he had seen the small movement of her stepping back. that he had stood there for a long moment with his hand on the wood of a door, breathing slowly, before he had walked on. On the eighth day, she met him. It was raining. She had gone to the library to find a new book for Lady Bramwell. The library was a long room with tall windows and a fire at one end. The smell of the room was wood and paper and old leather. The rain ran down the windows in long silver streaks. She had not known anyone was in the room. He was sitting in a deep chair by the fire. He had a book open on his lap. He was not reading. He was looking at the fire. She saw him first. She froze in the doorway. She thought for one wild moment of stepping back and closing the door and walking away. But that would be rude, and she had been raised to be many things, but not rude. She made a small curtsy. "Forgive me, Your Grace. I did not know the room was used." He looked up. Time slowed. The clock on the mantel ticked once. The fire shifted in the grate, and a small piece of wood fell with a soft sound. Somewhere outside, the rain grew heavier, and then softer again. He looked at her for the length of 3 full breaths, and she felt every one of them. His face did not move. His eyes did. They went over her face slowly, slowly, like a man who was reading a page he had been wanting to read for a very long time. He stood up. He set the book down on the small table beside the chair. He took one step toward her, and then he stopped, as if he had remembered something he had told himself. "Miss Ashby," he said. His voice was lower than she had expected. There was a small roughness at the edge of it, like a man who has not spoken for several hours. She did not know why this small detail made her hand close on the doorframe. "Your Grace," she said again, "you have come for a book." "Yes, for Lady Bramwell." "What does she wish to hear?" "Something kind," she said. He almost smiled. The corner of his mouth moved. He stopped it. "There is a small book of essays on the second shelf from the bottom, the blue cover. She likes it." "Thank you." She crossed the room. She kept her eyes on the shelves. She did not look at him. She knew the shape of him at the edge of her sight. Tall, dark coat, very still. She found the blue book. She drew it out. She turned back toward the door. He was still standing by the fire. He had not sat down again. "Miss Ashby," he said. She paused. "Have you been at Thornwood long enough to know its gardens?" "Only the close ones, Your Grace. The kitchen garden and the rose walk. There is a small library garden through that door. It is pleasant when the rain stops. I thought you might like to know." "Thank you," she said again. "That is kind." She did not look at his face. She did not see what was happening there. She gave him a small curtsy and left the room. She walked down the long hall with the blue book pressed against her chest. Her heart was beating in a strange, slow way, and she did not know why. In the library, the Duke stood by the fire for a long time after she had gone. He did not pick up his book again. He pressed his fingers against the mantel and looked at the place where she had stood. She had not known him. He had thought she might. He had thought there was a small chance. He had told himself many times not to hope, but a man tells himself many things, and not all of them are obeyed. She had not known him. Her eyes had passed over his face the way eyes pass over a stranger. He let out a long breath. He sat down in the chair. The fire moved. That was all right, he told himself. That was all right. She did not need to know him yet. She needed only to be safe and warm and seen for who she was. He had time now. He would not waste it. The next morning was bright. The rain had stopped in the night. The lawns were wet and the sky was pale and clean. Maren went out into the garden with Lady Bramwell. They walked slowly. Lady Bramwell leaned on Maren's arm. "You have met my great-nephew," Lady Bramwell said. It was not a question. "Yes," Maren said. "In the library, yesterday." "And?" "He was kind. He told me of a small garden."
"Did he?"
"Yes." Lady Bramwell said nothing more about it. They walked to a stone bench under a tree and sat down. The tree was an old apple tree, gnarled and bent, with new green leaves. A bee moved in and out of the white flowers. "He is not what people expect," Lady Bramwell said after a long while. "Your Grace?" "No, no. My great-nephew, the Duke, he is not what people expect." Maren did not know what to say. She kept her hands folded in her lap. "They expect him to be cold," Lady Bramwell said, "or proud, or stupid. He is none of those things. He is quiet. He sees things. He thinks about things. He is patient in ways that frighten most people." Maren felt something move in her chest. She did not know its name. "I do not say this for any reason," Lady Bramwell said. "I am old. I say things sometimes." But her eyes, when she turned them on Maren, were not the eyes of a woman who said things for no reason at all. Maren met those eyes for 1 second and then looked down at her own hands. The bee hummed. The apple flowers shook a little in the breeze. In the days that followed, Maren saw the Duke more often. Not in any planned way, not in a way that felt strange, but she saw him in halls, in the dining room when Lady Bramwell took her there for supper, in the garden once when he was speaking with the head gardener about a wall. He never approached her in a way that made her feel watched. He was always polite. He always inclined his head. He sometimes said a word or two about the weather, about the road into the village, about the book she was carrying. But he did not stand near her too long, and he did not look at her in any way that a stranger would have called strange. But Maren noticed something after a time. He remembered things. He remembered that she did not like tea brewed too strong, and the tea at supper was never too strong, though she did not know how he had learned that. He remembered that she had said in passing that she missed the small yellow flowers that grew along the lanes in the place where she had been a girl. And one morning there were small yellow flowers in a glass on the breakfast table, and the maid said the Duke had asked for them, though she did not say why. He remembered somehow that she did not like to be in a crowded room. When guests came to dinner once, in the second month of her stay, he arranged the table so that she sat near Lady Bramwell at one end, well away from the loudest voices. She had not asked for this. She had not told anyone. But he had known. She began, in spite of herself, to wonder about him. She did not know that one evening, in the dark of his study, the Duke had sat alone with a small wooden box on his desk. Inside the box were 5 years of small things, a pressed flower from a roadside in a county he had ridden through searching for her, a scrap of paper with the name of an inn where someone had once thought they had seen a young woman with her brown eyes, a folded handkerchief of plain linen which she had dropped in a small market town 3 years ago, and which a man he had paid had recovered and sent to him, and which he had touched too many times to count. He had opened the box. He had looked at its things. He had closed it again. He had locked it. He had put the key back in his pocket. He had told no one. The trouble came on the 40th day. It came in the shape of a carriage on the gravel drive, and a woman who stepped out of it in pale blue silk, and a smile that was not really a smile. Her name was Miss Honora Greaves. She was the daughter of a baronet from the next county. She was 22 years old. She was very beautiful, in a sharp way that made people careful. She had decided 2 years ago that she would marry the Duke of Marchcombe. She had not yet given up on this idea, though many other women had. She came up the steps in her pale blue silk, with her maid behind her, and a small white dog in her arms, and she swept into the front hall as if she had lived there all her life. "Where is he?" she said to the footman. "Tell him I have come. He will be glad." The footman bowed and went to find the Duke. The Duke was in his study. He was not glad. He had not invited her. But she was the daughter of a baronet, and her father was a friend of his late father, and to send her away from his door would be a coldness he was not willing to show. He went down to the front hall. He bowed. He said the proper words. He asked after her family. He invited her to stay for dinner. He arranged for a room. He did all of these things with a face that gave nothing away. Honora Greaves smiled. She had won, she thought. She would stay for 3 days. She would make herself useful. She would make herself charming. She would, before the third day was out, make him understand at last that they had been meant for each other since they were children. She did not see Maren until that evening at dinner. Maren came into the dining room with Lady Bramwell on her arm, as she always did. She wore her plain grey wool, as she always did. She walked to her seat without looking at anyone. She did not know there was a guest. No one had told her. Honora Greaves looked up from her place at the table. She saw the plain dress and the plain hair and the lowered eyes. She saw the way Lady Bramwell leaned on the young woman's arm with what looked like affection. She saw the way the Duke, at the head of the table, stood as both women came in, and how his eyes moved, for the briefest part of a second, not to Lady Bramwell, but to Maren. Honora Greaves understood many things very quickly. She smiled. The smile was bright. The smile was warm. The smile was the smile of a woman who has just decided to do something cruel and wishes to be sure no one sees the decision being made. Dinner began. The food was brought. The talk moved. "And who is this charming creature?" Honora said, looking across at Maren with her wide blue eyes. "I do not believe we have been introduced." "This is Miss Ashby," Lady Bramwell said, "my companion." "Oh," Honora said, "how kind of you, Lady Bramwell, to take in such a quiet little thing. She seems very sweet." The word little sat in the air for a moment. Maren did not look up. She cut her meat into a smaller piece. She did not bring it to her mouth. "She reads beautifully," Lady Bramwell said. Her voice had grown a small edge. "And she has a kinder mind than most women I have met in 40 years. "Of course," Honora said. "Of course. It is so important to be kind when one has nothing else." The room did not go silent. The clink of silverware went on. The fire moved in the grate. The footman behind the chair did not move. But Maren felt something close, very quietly, inside her chest. She had heard this kind of sentence many times in her life. She knew the shape of it. She lifted her eyes. She looked at Honora Greaves across the table. "You are right, Miss Greaves," she said. Her voice was very soft and very even. "Kindness is important, perhaps especially when one has so much else." Honora's smile did not change, but her hand on her wine glass went still. The Duke at the head of the table did not speak. He cut a piece of his own meat. He set the knife down. He looked at Honora Greaves for one long, slow second, and then he looked at Maren, and his face did not move at all, but something behind his eyes did. Maren ate her meat. She did not look at the Duke. She did not look at Honora again. The talk moved to other things. The fire crackled. Outside the long windows, a wind moved in the trees. After dinner, Lady Bramwell took Maren's arm and walked slowly with her up the great stair. "You handled that well," Lady Bramwell said quietly. "I should not have spoken." "You should have. You did. Do not unmake it." Maren did not answer. They went up to Lady Bramwell's room. Maren read for an hour from the Blue Book of Essays. Then she went to her own room. She sat on the edge of her bed. She did not cry. She had not cried in years. She pressed her palms together and held them there until the trembling in them stopped. She thought, "I cannot stay here much longer. I will be sent away when that woman speaks against me. I will lose this warm room and the lavender sheets and the kind old woman, and I will go again with nothing." She thought also of the Duke's face at the table. She did not know what she had seen there. She told herself she had seen nothing. She went to sleep at last. She slept badly. Far down the hall, in a study with the fire low, the Duke sat at his desk and wrote a letter. The letter was to his man of business in London. It was short. It contained two instructions. One was practical. The other was less so. Both were carried out in the days that followed. Honora Greaves stayed 2 days more.
In those 2 days, she found small ways to needle Maren. She asked her, in front of others, where her family had been from. She asked her, in front of Lady Bramwell, whether she had ever been to a London ball. She asked her, once in the Rose Walk, whether she had been disappointed not to marry. She asked these things with smiles and warm tones, and the air of a woman making polite conversation. Maren answered each question shortly. She did not look at Honora longer than she had to. On the third afternoon, in the drawing room, with Lady Bramwell asleep in her chair and a fire low in the grate, Honora moved at last to her clean blow. She came across the room. She sat in the chair beside Maren. She arranged her pale blue silk. She smiled. "Miss Ashby," she said softly, "may I speak with you as a friend?" "As you wish, Miss Greaves. I have been watching you. You are sweet, you are clever. You have made yourself very useful to the old lady, and I admire that." "Thank you. But I must be honest with you. I am to marry the Duke. It is understood between us. It has been understood since we were children. I do not want you to be confused about anything you may have imagined. You seem like a girl who could fall into a daydream. I would not wish it for you." Maren looked at her. She did not speak. Honora leaned closer. Her voice dropped. It became almost gentle. "A girl with no father, no name, no fortune," Honora said, "must be very careful what she lets herself want. There is nothing more pitiful in this world than a poor woman who believed, even for an hour, that a great man could love her. Do not be that woman, Miss Ashby. It would be a very sad thing to watch." The clock on the mantel ticked. The fire shifted in the grate. Lady Bramwell's small breath rose and fell from her chair across the room. Somewhere in the gardens, a bird sang a clear three-note song and then was silent. Maren did not move. She did not breathe for a long moment. The words sat inside her chest like small, hot coals. She felt them burn. She thought slowly of all the things she could say. She could weep. She could shout. She could deny that she had ever thought of him, which would not be entirely true. She could leave the room. She did none of these things. She stood up. She set her sewing down on the small table beside her chair. She smoothed her grey skirt. She looked at Honora Greaves once, briefly, in the eye. She did not let her face show anything. "Thank you, Miss Greaves," she said. "I will keep your kindness in mind." Then she walked across the room. She did not hurry. She paused at Lady Bramwell's chair and gently tucked the soft blanket more closely around the sleeping woman's knees. Then she opened the door, stepped through it, and closed it softly behind her. She walked down the long hall. She walked down the great stair. She walked out through the side door into the garden. The sun was low. The air was cool. The roses had small new buds on them. She walked all the way to the far wall, where there was a stone bench under a tree. And there, where no one could see her, she sat down. She put her hands flat on the cold stone. She pressed her palms into it until she could feel the rough grain through her skin. She did not cry. She breathed. She thought, "I must go. I must write to the agency tonight. I must ask for another place. I cannot stay where I am pitied like that. I cannot bear that woman's voice in my ear for another hour." She thought also, "I have nowhere to go." She did not know that someone had seen her leave the drawing room. She did not know that the Duke, returning from the stables, had passed through the side hall just as she had walked out of it, and had seen the look on her face, the calm, set look of a woman holding something in with both hands, and had stopped. She did not know that he had stood in the side hall for almost a minute, with his hand on the door, before he had turned and gone back to the drawing room himself. She did not know that he had opened the drawing room door without knocking, that he had found Honora Greaves smiling to herself in the chair beside an empty seat, that Lady Bramwell had been awake, Lady Bramwell, who had not been asleep at all, but had been doing as old women sometimes do, listening behind closed eyes. That Lady Bramwell had looked at her great-nephew and given him the smallest nod of her head. She did not know that the Duke had then sat down in the chair across from Honora Greaves and had asked her, in a very quiet voice, what she had just said to his great-aunt's companion. She did not know that Honora had grown pale, then pink, then very still. She did not know that the Duke had told Honora Greaves, in 5 short sentences, that her carriage would be ready in the morning, that her father would receive a letter from him by the end of the week, that he would never marry her, that he had never understood himself to be engaged to her, and that she would not be received at Thornwood Hall again. She did not know any of this. She sat on the cold stone bench under the tree, and she watched the sun go down. After a long while, she heard a footstep on the gravel path. She did not turn. She thought perhaps that it was a gardener. She kept her eyes on the wall. The footstep stopped a few feet away. "Miss Ashby." She knew the voice. She turned her head. The Duke stood on the gravel path. He had no coat. The light was going. The shadow of the tree fell on half his face. "Your Grace," she said. She made to stand. "Please," he held up one hand. "Do not stand. May I sit?" She nodded, because she did not know what else to do. He sat down on the far end of the stone bench. He did not look at her. He looked at the wall. He folded his hands together between his knees. For a long moment, neither of them spoke. A bird sang in the tree above them. The wind moved a little. The air smelled of cool earth and the first dew. "Miss Greaves leaves in the morning," he said at last. She turned her face toward him. "I have told her," he said, "that she will not return." "Your Grace, wait, please." She waited. He looked down at his folded hands. He took a slow breath. "I owe you," he said, "an honesty I have been keeping from you. I have been waiting to give it to you. I told myself I must wait until you were settled, until you trusted the place, until I was sure you could leave me again without being afraid. I told myself many things. Today I find I cannot wait any longer. May I speak?" "You may," she said in a voice that did not sound like her own. 5 years ago," he said, "there was a small assembly in the village of Pelham. It was a foolish thing, a country gathering with 3 musicians and a hall borrowed from an inn. I had ridden through that day on my way to a friend's house. I was 19 years old. I thought myself a serious young man. I did not wish to dance. I went only because my friend made me." She had gone very still. "I danced one set with a young woman in a dress the color of pale green leaves," he said. "She had brown eyes. She laughed at me because I was solemn. She told me I was funny, and I had never been called funny before. I asked her name. She told me her given name, but she would not tell me her family name. She said it would only make trouble for me. She said her people were not the sort of people whose name a young gentleman should know. She said it without bitterness. She said it as if she were doing me a kindness." The wind moved in the tree above them. A leaf came down and landed softly in Marin's lap. She did not look at it. "The music ended," he said. She curtsied. She walked away. By the time I had thought to follow her, she was gone. I asked at the inn. No one knew her name. I rode out the next morning. I told myself I would not think of her again. I was a fool. He was silent for a long moment. "For 5 years," he said very quietly, "I have been looking for you." She did not breathe. "I have hired men. I have written letters. I have ridden through more small villages than I can name. I had only your given name, and the year, and the place, and the color of your eyes. I had told myself again and again that you would not remember me, that you might be married, that you might be anywhere. I told myself to stop. I did not stop." He turned at last and looked at her. His face was tired in a way she had not seen before. There was something in his eyes she did not have a name for. 3 months ago," he said, "a man in my employ found a record of an Ashby family in a parish in Yorkshire. The father had been a clergyman. He had died. The mother had died before him. There was a daughter. She had gone into service. He found the agency. he found you. She put her hand to her mouth. I wrote the letter to the agency myself, he said. I asked for you by name. I told my great aunt only that you were a young woman of good character, in need of a kind place. She asked no questions. She trusts me. She also, I think, suspected more than I told her. She lowered her hand. Her eyes were very bright. She did not yet cry. I did not bring you here to ask anything of you, he said. I want you to understand that. I brought you here because for 5 years I have not been able to settle the thought of you, wondering where you were, whether you were safe, whether you were eating, whether anyone was kind to you. I could not bear it any longer. I needed to know that you were warm and safe and seen. I told myself that if you were happy elsewhere, I would set you up properly and let you go without ever speaking. I told myself that if you remembered me at all, I would let you choose what to do with the knowing. He stopped. He drew a slow breath. You did not know me, he said. I saw that in the library the first day. I told myself I could wait. I could be only a kind employer. I could let you have your peace. Today, when I saw your face as you came out of that drawing room, I understood I had been lying to myself. Whatever Miss Greaves said to you, and I have an idea of what she said, I could not let it stand. I could not let you carry that for 1 hour more than necessary. I could not let you believe you had been forgotten. She made a small sound. It was not a word. I thought you should know, he said, that you have not been forgotten. Not for a single day. The light was nearly gone. The sky behind the wall was deep pink and grey.
The smell of the cold garden rose around them. Wet stone, new grass, the faint scent of the small yellow flowers that grew at the foot of the wall, the ones he had asked the gardeners to plant the day after she had spoken of them, the ones she had not known he had heard her speak of. She tried to speak. Her throat would not work. She tried again. I, she said, I do remember you. He went very still. I did not know who you were here, she said. The Duke of Marchcombe. I had not made the... She stopped. She breathed. But I remembered the young man. I remembered him. I have remembered him for 5 years. He closed his eyes. The wind moved the leaves above them. I thought, she said, and her voice broke a very little, that I had imagined how kind his eyes were. I thought I had made it bigger in my memory than it was. I thought no one would have a face like that, truly, in the world. Maren, he said. It was the first time he had spoken her given name aloud since she had come to his house. He said it very softly. He said it the way a man says a word he has been holding in his mouth for a long time. The world slowed. The bird in the tree above them sang once and then stopped. The first star showed itself in the pink sky. She heard her own heart in her ears. She thought, this is the moment. This is the moment that everything I have learned about not hoping, not wanting, not letting myself believe, this is the moment that asks me to put all of it down. She did not know if she could. Your Grace, she began. Alistair, he said. She looked at him. My name, he said, if you can. She looked down at her hands. She looked at the leaf in her lap. She picked it up between her thumb and finger. She turned it slowly. It was small and yellow and shaped like a heart. Alistair, she said. He let out a breath he seemed to have been holding for 5 years. I cannot ask you anything tonight, he said. I will not. I want only, for now, for you to know what I have told you. For you to be in this house, and warm, and safe, and free to choose anything. Stay or go. Speak to me or not. Whatever you wish. I owe you that, after waiting so long without telling you. She did not answer at once. She sat with the small yellow leaf between her fingers. She thought of the seed cake on the first day, and the lavender sheets, and the small yellow flowers on the breakfast table, and the way the table had been arranged on the night the guests came,
and the way Lady Bramwell had said, "He is not what people expect." She thought of all of these things, and she understood, only now, that none of them had been chance.
She thought also of the woman who had said to her an hour ago that a poor girl must be careful what she lets herself want. She thought of that woman, and of how much that woman had been wrong about.
"I should like," Marin said in a small, steady voice, "to stay." He did not move. He did not look at her. He was afraid, she thought, that if he looked, he might be wrong about what he had heard.
"I should like," she said again, "to stay, Alistair, if you would have me."
He turned his head, the last of the light caught in his eyes. "I would have you," he said, "with everything I am." He did not reach for her. He did not move closer on the bench. He only looked at her, and she looked at him, and in the silence between them, all of the 5 years went by. Every empty hall and every cold lane, every small hope she had put down and walked away from, every village he had ridden through with her name in his mouth, all of it went by. And at the end of it, they were here, on a stone bench at Thornwood Hall, with the first star out. She lifted her hand from her lap. She held it open between them, palm up. She did not look at him as she did it. After a moment, his hand came to rest in hers. His fingers closed gently around her own. They did not grip. They simply rested there, warm against her cold skin, as if he had been waiting all his life to set his hand into hers, and now intended only to do so quietly. They sat that way for a long time. When at last she shivered, he stood. He took off his coat, a thing he should have done long before, and he laid it around her shoulders. The coat smelled of wood smoke and a faint, warm scent of cedar. She had smelled this scent in the great hall on the first day and had not known what it was. She knew now. He walked her back to the house. He did not take her arm. He walked a careful step beside her. Inside, in the warmth of the front hall, Lady Bramwell was standing at the foot of the stairs in her black silk, with her cane and her sharp, kind eyes. "There you are, child," she said to Marin. "I have had cocoa sent to your room. Drink it. Sleep. We will speak of nothing in the morning that you do not wish to speak of." She turned her sharp eyes on her great-nephew. "And you, Alistair, will go to your study and do no more thinking tonight. Enough thinking has been done in this house for one day." He bowed his head. "Yes, Aunt." Marin almost smiled. She went up the stairs with Lady Bramwell's hand light on her arm. At the top, before they parted, Lady Bramwell paused. She squeezed Marin's hand once. "He is a good man, child. He waited a very long time."
"I know," Marin said. Her voice was thick. "I know it now." She drank the cocoa in her room. She slept. She did not dream. In the morning, Honora Greaves's carriage left at dawn. Marin did not see it go. She heard the wheels on the gravel from her bedroom window, and she did not get out of bed to watch. There were many things in her life she had watched from windows. This was not one she needed to see. The days that followed were quiet ones. She read to Lady Bramwell in the mornings. She walked in the gardens in the afternoons. She saw the Duke, Alistair. She made herself think of him as Alistair, though she did not yet use the name aloud easily. At meals, and sometimes in the library, and sometimes in the garden. He did not press her. He did not ask her again for any promise. He did, however, begin to do small things she had not asked for. He gave her a small key on the third day. It opened a cabinet in the library that held the books he had read most often. "You may take any of them," he said. "Bring them back when you are done, or do not. Whichever you prefer." He told her on the fifth day about his mother, who had died when he was 12. He told her about a brother who had died in the war when Alistair had been 16, and about how the great house had felt for years after like a place too quiet for any one man to live in alone. He told her these things in the library, with the rain on the windows, in a voice she had to lean toward to hear. He listened on the seventh day,
when she told him about her mother, about the way her mother had taught her to read by candlelight in the rectory kitchen, about the small, clear voice her mother had used to sing in the church on Sundays, about how the world had felt when her mother had been in it, and how it had felt when she had not. He did not try to fix any of it. He only listened. One afternoon in the second week after Honora Greaves had gone, a kitchen maid named Polly came up to Maren in the side hall and curtsied. She was a thin girl of about 15, with red hair and a careful, watching face. "Beg your pardon, miss," she said. "What is it, Polly?" "I only wanted to say, that is, I wanted to thank you, miss, though it is not really you I should thank, but I do not dare thank him directly."
"Thank who, Polly?"
"His Grace, miss, the Duke." Maren tilted her head. "For what?" Polly looked at her own hands. Her voice grew very small. "My mother is sick, miss, in the village. She has been sick a long while. I could not afford the doctor from the town, and the one in the village is not... he is not always sober, miss. I would have lost her last month." "I am sorry, Polly."
"No, miss, you do not understand. She is better."
"The doctor from the town has been coming. He came 3 times. I did not pay him. Someone paid him. The doctor would not say. But Mrs. Crane in the kitchen heard from the doctor's man that His Grace sent word himself that the doctor was to come to my mother whenever I sent for him, and the bill was to be sent to him directly, and that I was not to be told." Polly looked up. Her eyes were wet.
"He never said. Not a word. I only found out by accident, miss. The doctor's man was drinking in the village last week, and he said something to my brother, and my brother told me."
"Oh," Maren said. Her hand came up to her chest slowly. "I cannot thank him, miss. He would not want me to, but I had to tell someone, and I thought you might know him, in the way I cannot. I thought you might know how to be glad about it for me."
"I will be glad about it for you, Polly," Maren said softly. "I am glad about it for you."
Polly curtsied and hurried away. Maren stood in the side hall for a long time after the girl had gone. She did not move. She watched the dust turn in a beam of light from a high window. She thought of a man sitting at his desk in his study, in the dark, writing a quiet letter that no one was meant to know about. She thought of a sick woman in a cottage in the village, sleeping safe under a roof that did not leak, with a doctor's medicine on the small table beside her bed. She thought of a girl named Polly, who would not lose her mother this year. She thought, "This is who he is. This is who he is when no one is watching." She walked slowly to the library. She knocked. She did not wait for an answer. She opened the door. He was at his desk by the window. He looked up. He set down his pen. "Maren?" She closed the door behind her. She crossed the room. She stopped a step away from his desk. She put her hands on the polished wood. "Polly's mother," she said. He did not move. Something behind his eyes did. "That was not for me to know," he said. His voice was quiet. "I know it was not. It was a small thing. It was not a small thing to Polly." He looked at his hands. He did not speak. "You did it without telling anyone," she said. "You did it because it needed doing. And you would have let no one know, ever, if a doctor's man had not been a drunkard." He almost smiled. The corner of his mouth moved. She came around the desk. She did not stop. She came until she was beside his chair. She put her hand on his shoulder. She had never touched him until that moment, except for the holding of his hand on the bench. "Alistair," she said. He stood up. He turned. They were very close. The fire moved in the grate. The clock on the mantel ticked. Outside, a horse moved in the stable yard, and a man's voice called something to another man. He looked down at her face. He did not move closer. "Maren," he said. "I have been thinking," she said, and her voice shook only a little. "I have been thinking since you spoke to me in the garden. I have been thinking about what I want. I had forgotten how to do that." "Tell me," he said. "I want to stay." She drew a breath. I want to stay, and I want what you offered. All of it. I am no great lady. I have no fortune. I have nothing to bring you. I have spent years making myself small. I do not yet know how to stop. But I want to learn with you, if you will be patient with me. I have been patient, he said softly, for 5 years. I find I am very good at it now. She made a sound that was almost a laugh and almost a sob. He lifted his hand. Slowly, with great care, as if she might break, he set his palm against her cheek. He did not pull her closer. He only let his hand rest there. His thumb moved once, very gently, across the soft skin under her eye. I do not want a great lady, he said. I want you. I have wanted only you since I was 19 years old. I do not know how to want anything else. She leaned her face into his hand. He bent his head. He pressed his forehead against hers. For a long moment, that was all. The fire moved. The clock ticked. She felt his breath on her face. She felt the warmth of his skin against hers. She did not cry. She breathed, slowly, into the small, warm space between them. Will you stay? He asked. Yes, she said. As my wife? Yes. He let out a breath. It was a small sound, but she felt the weight in it. 5 years of weight. Every road, every village, every cold inn where he had sat alone with the thought of her. Then we are home, he said. Both of us. At last. He did not kiss her. Not then. He drew back. He looked at her face as if he were learning it for the rest of his life. Then he took her hand. He brought it up. He pressed his lips very gently to the back of her fingers. Tomorrow, he said, you will tell my great aunt. She will pretend not to have known. She will weep one tear, and then tell us we are both fools and have wasted too much time already. That sounds like her. It is exactly her. He smiled at last. It was a small smile, but it changed his whole face. They were married 6 weeks later, in the small stone church in the village near Thornwood. Lady Bramwell wore black silk, as she always did, and she did weep one tear, and she did tell them they had wasted too much time, and she did not let go of Maron's hand for the whole walk back to the carriage. A year after that, on an afternoon in early spring, Maron sat in the small drawing room at Thornwood Hall with a book of poetry open in her lap. The fire was low. The smell of dried roses came from a bowl on the side table. Outside the window, the rain was beginning to come down in long silver streaks against the glass. The door opened. Alistair came in. He was carrying a small jar in his hand. Inside the jar were the first small yellow flowers of the season, lifted from the foot of the garden wall, where they grew now in a long, thick line, because every spring for the last several years, the gardeners had been told to plant more of them. He set the jar on the side table beside the bowl of dried roses. He did not say anything. He bent and kissed the top of her head. He sat down in the chair across from her. He picked up a book of his own. They did not speak for a long time. The fire moved. The clock ticked. The rain came down. After a while, she looked up at him. He was already looking at her. Alistair, she said softly. Thank you. He did not ask what for. He understood. He only smiled. That small, slow smile that changed his whole face, and reached his hand across the small space between their chairs. She set her hand in his. His fingers closed around hers gently, as they had on the stone bench under the tree a year ago, and every day since. They sat that way, hand in hand, while the rain came down outside Thornwood Hall, and the small yellow flowers in the jar shone bright as candles in the soft grey light. 5 years of cold lanes and empty halls, and small private hopes set down and walked away from, had ended in this one warm room, with a fire low in the grate, and a man who had never, even for a single day, forgotten her. Thank you for staying with this story until the very end. If this moved you, please like, share, and subscribe. Your support keeps these stories alive.